Shalom Aleichem, Chevra. We want to welcome you on behalf of National Council of Young Israel for our conference call with Rebbe. This is conference call number 137. Thank you, Rebbe.
You're very welcome. One, I'm the Rebbe of a local shul. The Gabbai notices that joint davening a kaiman is a reading from a local Jewish newspaper, which contains, among other things, divrei Torah from many gedolei Yisrael, but he's not talking. Is the Gabbai justified in singling this person out, going so far as to tell him to leave the Beis Knesset? If people ask the Gabbai why the congregant is asked to leave, could he say that he is disrespectful of the covenant of the shul? What if the person is talking in shul? Could he be labeled a Rasha? Finally, if the congregant was learning Mishnah Berurah or any Torah Sefer, the Gabbai go over and discourage it, but not take it to this extreme. Mishnah Berurah writes in 7 Kuf Chav Dalas of Kod Yud Zion that you should not be learning during Chazorah Sashatz. That's true. But Chas V'Shalom, to throw him out of the shul? First of all, the Gabbai is not the boss. The Rav is the boss. And the Rav should tell this individual the psak of the Mishnah Berurah, and hopefully he will keep the psak. You should mention that the Bar Hetev in Sivkot and Zion quotes the Mogen Avraham, Sivkot and Ches, from Ramami Panu, that Ein Limchos B'Yodam, that those who learn during Chazorah Sashatz, we should not protest against it. So certainly you cannot evict him. You should tell him that the Psak, which is more accepted as the Mishnah Berurah, should not be learning. It should be focused on the Chazorah Sashatz. If he's talking, Shulchan Aruch writes in Siv Zayin, Chote v'godol avonam and so v'gorim bo. The sin, and you should scold him. Mishnah Berurah says, Sivkot Chav Zayin, should appoint special people to enforce this. And there's some shuls that are destroyed because of this sin. I'd like to say many shuls become dysfunctional because the neighborhood empties out. And that may be a result of this sin. I tell people your real estate value will go down. It's not worth it to talk in shul. You look at the deer shul, there in footnote 48, quotes the Shevet HaLevi, that in some cases, the Efshar, it's impossible to enforce this. The Yikabel Schara LaPrisha. Every Rebbe has to know what is a Dabba Nishma, what is a Dabba Sheina Nishma, and that's a local decision for every Rebbe. Sadly, in many shuls, there are people talking straight to a shul. It's really not right. We try very hard to maintain the Koran. Is the famous Tosis Yontif, Mishnah Berurah, quotes it somewhere, that the Gezeres Tach V'Tat was caused by talking in shul as a possession of Mishnah Berurah. It's the story of one of the great rabbanim of the last generation. They made an impassioned speech and said to Mishnah Berurah that the Tosis Yontif Mishnah Berurah was silent for the entire Musaf. Next week, it was only silent during the Mishnah Berurah of the Tosis Yontif. And the following week, they spoke to that too. This is a great rabbi and a big shul. You have to be careful to know what is nishma and what is not. Question two. A member of my community is moving to a new home. Until the new house is ready, he will pack up his old house and the moving company will hold his possession in storage until after Pesach. What does he do about the chametz in the boxes? He has no idea where it will be stored and nobody can get access to it. He doesn't know who owns the company. Seems to me, strictly speaking, there's no problem storing the chametz in those boxes, the same as he sells all of those chametz every single year. If you give something as a pikadon, someone's watching it for you, halachically it's called shalom u'brishuso, belongs to you and it's considered under your control. Seems to me that ultimately he would be able to access it in an emergency of some sort. Let's say he has some medicine there and someone's going to die if he can't get that medicine. There would be he'd find a way how to access it. And the fact that he doesn't know where it is, in any pikadon, you don't know where it is. Reuven gives it to Shimon. Shimon puts it somewhere else. Reuven can be makdish, can sell it, even though he has no idea where Shimon put it. At the end of the day, he'd be able to get it back. Shimon's not denying it. It's not a gezel. If someone stole something, then any ochel hakdish ain't a b'shusa. But the pikadon is considered b'shusa, and therefore he can sell it. Question three. Does the Indian not to be a standard for two boys of the same family apply? even if the father is being tzaddik. I understand that according to many opinions, there is an inyan for the father to be tzaddik if he is not the moel. There are a lot of inyans in this world. Where we come from, this is something which is normally not practiced. And once in my life, I saw the father being tzaddik. I've been in many brisen, and it's just, it was very an exception. That's not our minig. It's not our, we don't have that inyan. You always want to cover somebody else. And therefore, it seems to me that his father shouldn't be a tzaddik even once, and certainly not twice. Four. About the bus, that was at a set menu which is after Vasikin time. He wants to know if he should say Kriyashma right before Nait, without the brachas, to be owed to the midst of Kriyashma at the optimal time. This is a, we can spend an hour on this question. It seems to me this is a machlokas between Rabbi Niona and the Rashba. Rabbi Niona says that you should say Kriyashma before Nait. Why? Because the impression conveyed is that the majority of the people are getting up before Netzach Hamah. We can only say Kriyas Shema because Derech B'nei Melachim, the minority, gets up after sunrise. And the Ramban writes in Brachas and the Melchamas at the beginning, Rabbeinu Yonah and Ramban and Mechutonim, they both agree that it's better to fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyas Shema in the optimal time, which is when the majority is getting up. So Rabbeinu Yonah says, based on the Gemara later on in Brachas, someone's in the mikveh, he should say the Kriyashma under the water in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Shema before sunrise, even though that means, according to the understanding, forfeiting Smichas Gula Tefillah. So it's very, very important, according to Rabbeinu Yonah and Ramban, to say the Shema before sunrise. I believe Morena Rabbeinu Rav Shechta follows this Ramban Rabbeinu Yonah in doing so. However, if one looks more carefully in the Rashba, he seems to disagree. And if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, you get the impression that he follows the Rashba and not Rabbeinu Yonah and not the Ramban. One who wants a longer discussion, please look at my Sefer Am Morach and Brochas, page Kuf Mem Tes to Kuf Nun Aleph, where it's described at great length. So while someone who says the Shema before Nait certainly has what to rely upon, both in our generation and in the Gedolim of hundreds of years ago, seems to me that the Shulchan Aruch follows the Rashba, and that seems to be the more common custom, not to say Shema. Why not? What do you lose? The answer is, here there is, I will call it an inyan, to paraphrase the last question, but an inyan to say the Kriya Shema D'Oraisa, al Seder HaBrochos. And somebody who says the Shema before Nait is Yotzi the Shema D'Oraisa then, and then later on when he davens, it's not the Shema D'Oraisa, al Seder HaBrochos. It seems to be the opinion of the Rashba and the Shulchan Aruch. Number five. And when used the challah, which is still frozen, wrapped in aluminum foil in a plastic bag, as a lecha mishnah, when making hamotzi on Shabbos. This is the machlokas. If you look in the Dirshu version, Mishnah Brewer Simon Reish Ayin Dalet, the first footnote, he quotes that the Minchas Yitzchak and Rav Nissen Karelitz and the Ola Tzion all say yes. Shlomo Zalman and the Sheva Halevi are not sure. Shlomo Zalman wants to be lenient only in the case in which the challah will become usable, become unfrozen, while he's eating the suda. Therefore, it seems to me a person should try to be machmir when he can, unless it's a shas hadchak. And if it's a shas hadchak, try to make the, even if you're not going to use that challah, try to warm it up so it should be edible before the suda ends. Question six. Why don't we say Kashi of the same Tillim for Eretz Yisrael at the end of davening by an event that starts with the Perek of Tillim? Excellent question. Look at Mishnah Brura in Simen Nun Heis of Kod Nalav. Tov Lamayit V'Kadesh. It's a habit of people saying Kaddish. It's better not to say so many Kaddish. Better not to say so many Kaddish. This is what Rav Henkin said and others, but really Mishnah Brura. Therefore, that's the meaning not to say Kaddish. Seven. Should a child that goes to sleep before hearing Avdolah Motzei Shabbos make Avdolah on Sunday morning? The custom is he does not make Avdolah. How do we explain it? Avdolah is a chiv of chinuch. When the boy turns by mitzvah, he will not go to sleep so early. And therefore, he will be making Avdolah on Motzei Shabbos itself. And therefore, there's no need to be mechanechim when he goes to sleep early to make Avdolah on Sunday morning. Eight. In consideration of the situation there in Israel, what, if any, changes should be incorporated into Purim this year? Should the Suda and Mesiba be changed in any way? Should we limit what our kids do? Kids, I mean, under Bar Bas Mitzvah, should not be limited. For them, Purim is a very memorable occasion, and they're plucked from the other obligations that we have to be more mindful of the situation in the Holy Land. However, with respect to all those of age, I believe that although there is a chiyuv to be mesameach, even in a difficult time, but we have to do something to tone it down somewhat. Certainly, to eliminate holilus. Holilus is frivolity, which sadly creeps into Purim, and frankly, we should cut it out every year. But we should take the opportunity to eliminate a year like this. I believe in our yeshiva that they're not going to have the spiel in front of the whole Olam on Purim night, which is a very good idea. Hope they continue with in following years as well. Every situation is different. Every shul, every yeshiva, you have to know where you can tone it down. I think that they're going to end up having our yeshiva have some slow music at the end, and even the negunim of the fast music is going to be monitored to have in tunes of emuna, if reflecting the fact that although it's Purim, we haven't forgotten the situation in the Holy Land. 9. This past Shabbos, my son was in shul where they would not have a kohen for Parshat Kisisa. They called up a Levi b'mkom kohen and read the first two aliyahs for the Levi so that it would not give the Yisrael an aliyah of the Chet HaEgel. Well, this is the nice of our Torah, not to embarrass the Yisrael, is that l'maisa, what is supposed to be done? I don't know what it says in the Svarim, but I believe that they did the right thing. It is quoted. They have these humongous aliyahs, first in Kisisa, for that particular reason. So, if there's no Kohen, usually if there's no Kohen, I prefer not to call a Levi at all. My Rabbi preferred to call a Yisrael and not a Levi, based on two different opinions in Rashi. One has been the Sparda Chavila and the one Masechta Gittin. But in this particular case, I think, although I have no proof for or against, that with the Shul that was right. 10. Many items are left in Shul Kodemish for many weeks, such as raincoats, ties, sweaters, and books. Can these be thrown out? Or do we say they become a Shomer Aveda? If yes, can an email be sent out that all items not claimed within 30 days will be thrown out? Absolutely, you should send out an email. But much more importantly, you should put up a sign in the coat room. Tell people in advance. And when they hang their coat, they should know that if it's kept there for 30 days, it's going to be thrown out. Because the email which is sent out now is not so simple that it works for things which are put there before the email. Perhaps for Shas HaTchak. But more important than the email, there should be a sign, at least going forward, that it explains clearly to anybody that hangs up a coat, these are the conditions of use. 11. A husband passed away. The children want to sell the house and split the money as a Yerusha and buy the mother a cheaper home. So they have the right if their mother wants to remain in the house. B. That same house is a rental apartment earning an income. Whose money is it, the wife or the Yerusha? Take a step back. Typically in America, a home is owned by a couple. Typically, husband and the wife. And in that situation, if the husband passes away, American law and the law agree that the house passes directly from husband to wife. Survivorship. That is the typical case. So in typical case, this whole question doesn't even begin. The children have no right to any of the money. The house cannot be sold. It actually belongs to their mother. That's what should be done. What happens if that was not done? Let's say the husband had it only in his name for whatever reason. And there can be certain reasons. I know of a case where the house was in joint ownership as always, but then the husband was terminally ill, and for tax purposes they transferred it to him. So when he passed away, there were no taxes. I'm not an accountant. In such a situation, you want to know they have a right to sell the house? The answer to that question is also no. Look at Evan Ezer, one of the chiyuvim that a husband has to his wife when he marries her, is that he should provide her with a dira, and the dira is not only when he's alive, but even after he passes away, she has a right to stay in the home. Sugi Masech Tuksubis, and therefore we should not tell the mother that she has to leave. She can stay in the house as long as she wants. This is true not only if it's the mother. It's true if it's the husband's second wife. If the mother passed away, that happened in my family. My mother passed away. My father remarried him, and he passed away. We told his wife She can stay in the house as long as she wanted to. That's what it says in the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch. So therefore, she has a right to stay there. Now, there's a rental apartment and an income. Whose money is it? The wife or the husband? Now, that's a serious question. In this case, which I think is a rarity, I hope it's a rarity. In that situation, I would say like this. It would be better for the husband, even if, for some reason, the house belongs to him only, to write a savor, a will, which has a lachic import and standing, because we call it in our language a shtar chas yizachar. This is something which asked by Rabbi Shech, the Shalita, years ago. I wrote a document with an introduction. It was just spruced up a little bit. You can find it on the Bank of America website. And that in his will should say that his money, when he dies, goes to his wife. Why? Number one, it will prevent a sad situation in which a mother is dependent on her children. That's a bad thing. Someone gives away all his property to his children and then depends upon his children. That's not a good situation. Not a good situation. This will should be written in the case in which the house is not jointly owned. I think the will should be written anyway because there are other properties sometimes. The money should go to the spouse in both directions. The children should depend on their parents and not the other way around. That's what I believe. If there was no such will, technically speaking, it goes to the Yorshim. You can't deny it. It goes to the Yorshim. Those are the sons. It seems to me, however, that they are responsible to maintain the dignity of their mother as a mitzvah of kibud eim. Now, it's true, we paskin mishel avoim. So technically speaking, they're not required to spend their own money in order to give it to their father and mother to honor them. It seems to me, if she lacks the means to maintain herself properly, if they don't support her properly by letting her stay in the house, or give her the rental income which she needs to keep herself going, that's a bizoyan. And to be mevazeh a parent is not allowed. You don't say the idea of mishalav, mishalben, except for kibbutz, it seems to me that bizayin would be prohibited in all instances. Number 12, a person has a chavrusa, so they learn together 6 days a week. I assume for payment. If the chavrusa misses a day, can he be charged for that day, being that he, the teacher, rather learn with him, and schar batola has no value to him? This is a complicated question. On a simple level, the answer is yes, but we cannot give a sweeping answer because there are many details. 13. Chicken that was made with some oil in on Shabbos, he wants to put it on an upside-down aluminum pan on the blech, being that it's dry. Would there be a concern of yesh tzliach habishul? If yes, would challah also be permitted if it will get toasted? This is a complicated story. Complicated story. Chicken that was made with some oil. That's a tricky phrase, some oil. These days, most of the chicken that I see is not made in a pot. Notwithstanding the phrase, a chicken in every pot, it's primarily barbecued, roasted. Even though it has some oil, we would not consider that to be a bishul. It would also be a tzli. It would be probably considered tzliach ha-tzli, made with some oil. But let's assume, to make the question sharper, it was cooked. It was cooked. And now you want to heat it up. It's a problem of tzliach ha-bishul. That's a more serious question. Challah is less of a question because that might be called tzliach harafia, which is less of a problem because they're both dry. In my view, it depends. If it's a change in taste, then it's a potential problem. This refers to toasting bread. You toast bread, so it's a kind of a, you could even call it an afiach harafia. It's a question because you're changing the taste. That may be a problem on Shabbos. If it does not change the taste, it seems to me that it's permissible. And therefore, if you have this even cooked chicken, you put it on a blech, it's not going to change the taste of the chicken. So it still be taste like cooked chicken, not like roasted chicken. It seems to me that would be okay. Once again, this is something which is a bit complicated. And if you want to see my opinion in greater length, look at my Sefer Am Mordechai and Shabbos on page Samachay, where this is discussed. Question number 14. Have you made aware that a congregant in my shul is on paid leave while his company investigates a sexual harassment allegation? If I know, then others know as well. What is my responsibility to the kehillah and to protect my family and myself if it gets out that I knew but did not speak with shul leadership? I don't understand the question. If others know, then others know. So the shul leadership should also know. I'm not sure why it's this person's responsibility to get involved. We have to remember that allegations are sometimes true and are often false. We know of cases of people who have allegations against them, individuals who are with the first name of a rabbi, and they're absolutely false, absolutely false. And sadly, in some cases, it costs the person his job unfairly. In other cases, he's put on what we call leave, even from a Clay Kodesh position, because, you know, the yeshiva can't take a chance. But the simple fact is that the person is completely innocent. At the same time, that is not the responsibility of every person who happens to know about it, especially if it's not a well-kept secret. Others know about it. The shul leadership should take care of it on their own. The person himself, if he wants to be a whistleblower, let him do his own private investigation. And if he finds it's really a true allegation, then he should be careful himself, and they should warn others to be careful as well. But if he has done no investigation, the most he can do, it seems to me, is to, quote, protect his family from this unsubstantiated allegation. If it's substantiated, then of course he has to say something. If no one knew about it but himself, I would say, perhaps as the only person who knows it, he should at least tell the president of the shul, listen, Mr. President, you don't know about this. No, it's a top set secret. This allegation exists, but you should do some investigation to know how to deal with it. Probably best to speak to the rabbi, who will be more judicious in taking proper measures. Sadly, there's been so much abuse, so much harassment, we have to be especially cautious about it. I'm the first to agree. But you have to be also careful on the other side. The fact that the company has them on paid leave does not necessarily mean that there's any guilt whatsoever. Could be there's a terrible guilt, could be there's some guilt, could be there's no guilt. So it seems to me that a further investigation is warranted. 15. The Beganeva's dad to move down to a better seat at a baseball game than the seats were paid for. I am not an expert. They told me it's Geneva's mammon, not Geneva's das. They're utilizing the possession of the stadium against their wishes. For some reason, they don't want you to do that. I'm not an expert in the rules. Someone told me that in the later innings, they don't care about it anymore. It all depends on what's happening. It's not a Geneva's das. It's a Geneva's mammon issue. 16. Is there an inyan? Again, the word inyan. For an Avil in his 12th month of Davin from the Amud, even though he's not Tekadish. A big dispute. Some of it is an Indian, some of it is a Dafkan Indian, not the Davin. Seems to me if a person wants to do it, he's allowed to do it. But of course, he would not be able to displace any real Chiyuv who has Kadima. 17. A wonderful Yid of Persian descent is a prominent member of my shul, which by his bylaws follows us from Ashkenaz. He recently lost his father and has been saying Kaddish. He told me that his Persian poskim told him that he must recite the Kaddish of his Mesorah. May only daven for the Yomim in his Nusach. They told him he may not recite any other version of Kaddish or Tefillah, despite what he is davening, where he is davening. He has declined to daven for the Yomim based on his Pesach, but recites the Eidot and Mizrach Kaddish with all his additions. Most of the others saying Kaddish have learned to pause when he recites his additions, the Yatzmach, and the longer one, the fact that I would direct Balabatan to Rav Moshe's psak of following the minhag of the minyan when one davens is a moot point, since he was given an opposing psak. Others in the minyan can't understand why we have various kaddishes recited. Another member whose family minhag is Nusach Svar Ari asked if he could say Yasmach along with this gentleman. I told him he should not face Rav Moshe's psak. We want everyone to feel comfortable. We want to avoid the Wild West. But the Rav agreed that not making macha on the different kaddish and the other man not reciting Yatzmach, what advice for this scenario? I have a simple advice. Go speak to the Persian poskin. His Persian poskin. And tell them, we respect your right to tell everybody in your shul to follow the Persian psak. We do not respect your right to someone in our Ashkenazi shul to follow your psak. The same as we would not want to tell an Ashkenazi to go to your Persian shul and violate your custom. Right? He will skip the Asaf HaKoni and go ahead, or other things. There is a concept of Minhag HaMakom. This is something that's very important. I would hope that the Persian poskim will accede to the wish of the Ashkenazi posek, but the understanding, there's a mutual understanding in both directions. You don't want us to send our Ashkenazim to your shul and goof up your Minhagim. That's the best solution to this problem. I would certainly hope that the Persian poskim would understand, as we would understand, telling a person in our shul, if he went to that shul, he should say the Asaf HaKoneh, or at the very least, pause and not run through and confuse the tzibur over there. The last question is the following situation. A person follows the minhag of the Gra. The Gra said that you have 2 yard sets in a year like this. Two. The Mechaber says you follow only the second order. The Ramah said you only follow the first order. The question will be, this individual, does he have Kadima and other Shani over anybody else? It seems to me, he's an Ashkenazi shul, he followed the Ramah, he has Kadima over nobody else. He followed the Ramah. He wants to keep 2 yard sets. That's fine. It's admirable to follow the opinion of the Vilna Gaon. He can say Kaddish, of course. Talking about a shul, everybody says Kaddish, not like they have in German communities. Everyone says Kaddish. He can turn into the Kaddish. If there's no one else, not for the Ahmed, Bavakasha. He wants to be strict like the Vilna Gaon. I wonder if people fast on the Yahrzeit, but he also strict like the Vilna Gaon. You know, it's easy to down for the Yomid. Again, if I have no Yahrzeit and other, I don't want to say anything. But, it's, you know, first I have to take these into consideration. Does he always follow the Vilna Gaon's shittas? So, a person has the right to follow the strict of you. He doesn't have the right to follow that strict of you on the cheshbon of somebody else. Thank you very much.
Rebbe, we thank you. And Mr. Shem, we're pleased to call Rebbe on Rebbe again. Wish everyone a Freilich HaPurim. Thank you.